Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
Happy Olympics weekend, friends, and welcome to the podcast. Follow us on Spotify right now and you'll get this every Friday. It's a selection of my favourite chats from the last few days as a warm ear hug for you, and I hope you're enjoying your weekend, but this will make it even better. Now, what's on this week's episode? We have three Olympians on Ireland's Paris predictions. We've a woman who cleans up crime scenes and an on-the-ground view of the Coolock protests. Our first chat is with Michael Carruth, who was in studio with us 32 years after his own gold medal success in Barcelona, and he talked about, of course, the Paris 2024 Games underway. He was the first gold medal winner for Ireland since Ronnie Delaney in Melbourne 1956, and he really lit up when we played him that clip of Jimmy McGee's famous commentary from Michael Carruth's famous win. David Gillick and growing Murphy, also Olympians for Ireland. They looked ahead to the Irish field of athletes in athletics and swimming and other sports as we mark a century since Team Ireland first entered the Games. After that, we meet Alana Gillan. She's a lovely woman with a very unusual job. She told us about her profession as a trauma scene cleaner. So she goes into houses to clean up after somebody's passed away, where there's trauma often, sometimes even where there's been a murder. And what might appear to be a very grisly endeavour and career is actually something that involves a lot of compassion on her part. And it was quite moving to hear from her. And she told us also about the training and the science behind that work, a job that you didn't even know existed. And at the end of the podcast, we go into the Coolock protests that have been happening in Dublin with somebody who's actually living in Coolock. He has been there for over 40 years. His name is George Finglas. He loves the place and loves the people and has been distraught that the name of Coolock has been dragged through the mud with these protests. And George actually got in touch with the show. He was telling us about the fog of fear hanging over his beloved community in the last 10 days or so, ever since those protests over plans to turn an old warehouse into immigration accommodation exploded into violence. He got a huge response from our audience, who really liked his common sense approach to a very, very tricky issue. And he just says we need to tease out the grey parts of this immigration debate. It was a very refreshing take on things from inside an area that's been hit by those protests. That's everything in this week's podcast. Listen right through to the end, please, to be fully restored to knowledge, of course. And then you can go about your business and wait for Monday, because I'll be back on the wireless RT Radio 1 from 9 until 10 every weekday. Nothing further for me to say here, so let's start the weekend podcast.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.
All right, we're back. 51551, that's the text. oliver@rte.ie is the email. The five Olympic rings, they are hanging upon La Tour d'Eiffel. The Eiffel Tower in the City of Lights is ready for Paris 2024. It's 100 years exactly since Team Ireland first entered these modern games, and a century after it was Paris 1924. We're sending the largest ever group of Irish athletes. The hopes are huge. We're going to be joined this morning. We are joined this morning by three Irish Olympians. Boxing gold medal winner Michael Carruth from the Barcelona Games. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you.
In the studio. David Gillick, athletics pundit for RTE and Olympian in Beijing. He's on the phone. Are you there, David?
I am.
He is. Brilliant. And Grainne Murphy, we'll be talking to her as well in a second. RTE swimming pundit for the Games. She was our Olympian at London 2012. Grainne.
Morning. How
She's
are you?
She's there. Yeah, delighted you can join us. And they know for sure what goes in to these next few weeks for these athletes. Boy, do they know. And in those 100 years, Michael, I think there's only 9 Irish people ever, isn't there, that have gold Olympic medals, and you're one of them.
I'm one of them, yeah. Thankfully for that, yeah. So, but air sport boxing is, as you know, has always produced, you know, for the want of a better word. And
well, since you were the first gold medal.
I was the first ever boxer, to win a gold medal, yeah. But like, we'd won a lot of medals prior to that as well, back in the day as well. So, it was great that we finally got over that hurdle, and now obviously Kelly winning her Olympic gold medal and Katie winning an Olympic gold medal, so we need another boy this time now to win another Olympic gold medal.
The gender bias is very good. And Ronnie Delaney, you were the first gold medal, weren't you, since Ronnie Delaney
in 56.
And Ronnie's still with us. He's 89 years of age this year. And was it life changing for you?
Of course it was, in the sense that, you know, like, I went off to Barcelona as maybe that I could do, you know, I could get a bronze medal or something like that. Obviously, Wayne McCullough was on the team. Paul Griffin was on the team. Paul was a European champion. Wayne was Commonwealth champion. So the onus was probably more on those two than me to say, watch Carruth, he could slip in the back door, you know what I mean? So, and of course, I let them have the kind of, I'm not saying the glory, but like I let them have all the kind of limelight in the sense that I said, if I do everything that I have to do right, I can meddle here, you know. So was
the attention on them going into
more
the,
so? Yeah, it would have been. You know,
that must have helped you then, a small bit.
Of course, yeah, because I there was no pressure on me, you know. Even when Wayne lost in the final, like I was expected to lose against Juan Hernandez Sierra from Cuba, you know, 6'7", me 5'7" on my tippy toes, you know, both my hands were broken, you know, so. It was a lot of things people didn't know about in that fight. We couldn't.
Both your hands were.
Yeah, we couldn't divulge it because I wouldn't have. I got through the medic. So when you were doing the medics, they were holding your hands and you're trying not to make their face because you know they see a little clinch or something.
So
with that, now they weren't bad breaks, but you know, again the next part was. I was not expected to beat Juan Hernandez, you know what I mean? So, but all the pressure was on him then, you know?
The moment, Jimmy McGee is the guy who obviously is that member. Here it is, 1992, Michael Carruth.
And the bell goes at the end of exchanging with hands when Austin Carruth comes in, cool and crisp his son. Michael Carruth is the champion of the Olympics.
We are smiling broadly again.
Yeah, yeah. I love that part, that one with Jimmy, you know, the champion. That's what he says, you know. So, and believe it or not, when you look at Jimmy, you know, Jimmy hadn't seen an Olympic gold medal being won.
For sure, yeah.
When at that time as well, and such a great wonder for RTE and a great friend of boxing in general. And for him to see the first Irish guy to win an Olympic gold medal at boxing was a great time for him as well.
It was really special.
Yeah.
You turned pro then, didn't you?
I turned pro for a short time after. And then
Did it not work? Didn't go so well? Or
it wasn't that. Yeah, I probably turned a bit too late, in my age. You know, so, and with that, you know, I had a lot of fights. I won a version of a world title, but to me it wasn't a real title. I had a fight in Germany for a world title and I felt I won that fight, but I didn't get the decision. But that's it. And the minute you lose a fight in professional boxing, you're forgotten about. You know? They don't want to know you anymore. You know?
Really?
So it's a ruthless business. It absolutely is.
Because
you, know?
You have to be the top of the poster.
You have to be winning all the time. Yeah. You know? So.
Good Lord. Mm. And you were, your career-wise, you were in the Defence Forces, were you?
I was in the Army for nearly 10 years, yeah.
So you were technically a soldier when you went to Barcelona?
Barcelona, yeah.
Okay.
So I'm a twice Olympian. I went to the 88 Olympics and I got beaten in my second fight. And I was really struggling on the weight category that I was in at that time. And I had nothing in me, you know, and I got beaten in my second fight from a guy who I had beaten already 6 months previous in Denmark in the Copenhagen Box Cup. And that lad actually got to the final of the Olympic final of that weight category. So it was a long 4 years' wait to get back in and try really redeem myself. You know?
Yeah. But it's fantastic memories and it's great to chat to you. Thanks for coming in this morning.
No problem at all.
Like I said, 9 people in 100 years with Olympic gold medals and you're one of them.
And we've got 10 boxers now going to these Olympics. I said we'll qualify 10 boxers and I'm going to say live and air here that we will probably win 3 medals minimum.
Really?
We're that strong. You know?
Wow.
And particularly our girl team. Every weight division has been qualified, which is phenomenal. You know, so hopefully the boys as well. You know,
Kelly, do you think she'll?
Kelly could, yeah, spring back, no problem. Yeah, she's got the quality. She's got the, you know, she's an Olympic champion. There's no pressure on her going to this one.
That's right, and she's going to retire straight away afterwards. So she'll have
whatever
all of
that. She wants to do. She's had a great career, no matter what happens in Paris, Kelly has been an absolute role model for young women and boxers in this country.
It'll be hard though to retain a gold medal. I mean, a silver would.
It's not easy. It's not easy retaining it. You know what I mean? Because you have younger books coming up against you as well. You know
that's
what I mean?
Right.
So like Katie didn't defend hers either. So it's not that easy to defend.
It's very tough. You know? Who else do you think are you looking out for then?
Any of them. You know, you're looking at six girls. Like you know, you got Dana Morehouse. You got Jennifer Lahan. Yeah. You got Aoife O'Rourke. You know, you got Grainne Walsh. Michaela Walsh, like any of these could win medals. Any of our boxers could win medals. Like it depends on the draw, you know, what way the draws go.
And
any of the four boys could easily do it as well, you know. So, So I'm looking forward to, you know, looking forward to sitting down and watching them and screaming at the television.
And it's going to be early enough as well, isn't it?
It will be.
Will be underway next week.
Next week they'll be started.
Excitement. Yeah. David Gillick is on the line. David, you were Beijing Olympics back in 2008. You'll know what it feels like, won't you, being the Olympian, going into the stadium and that moment when you realise you're there, you're representing your country.
Yeah, look, in 2008, it was obviously, look, it's something I dreamt of as a little kid. And even as Michael's talking there about, like, winning the gold medal, I can remember sitting at home and watching that, you know, and champion. Like, those are the words that ring true and inspire a generation. And for me, look, to get the opportunity to go to the Olympics was fantastic. And it probably wasn't even going out into the bird's nest in Beijing. It was actually the warm-up track. I can remember going down to the warm-up track probably a day or two before my race, and I can remember just looking up and seeing the Olympic flame, and it was just so surreal. It was literally, I was just kind of pinch myself moment that I'm actually here at the Olympic Games, and you know, everything that had kind of gone through to get to that moment, and that's what a lot of our athletes kind of, you know, that the things you don't see, the graft, the hustle over the years, the lifetime of work that goes into that moment. And I got to be honest, like, the Olympics for me, it didn't go as planned, and you know, it's great to hear the success stories, but there'll be a lot of athletes that may come back a little bit disappointed, and I was one of them coming back from Beijing. It just didn't pan out the way I wanted to. But, you know, it's probably in subsequent years you look back and, you know, the memories and everything that went into that, like the people around me, my friends, my family, my coach at the time as well. But it's one of those moments that, you know, you cherish, because the Olympics is the pinnacle of my sport, athletics, and it was great to be there and great to be part of a great team.
I mean, what is it like then when you do come back in those first few weeks and you're only thinking negatively, are you, towards it?
Yeah, well, it's kind of one of these things. Like, it is a championship, and it's a moment where you want to go and you want to perform to your best. You know, I had a great year in 2007. I had a great year in 2009. But 2008 just didn't pan out the way I wanted to. I was in good form. I was running fast times before the Olympics. But I went in and... And look, you know, hindsight's always great. Maybe the emotion of it all, maybe the pressure, the anxiety maybe got to me a little bit. But, you know, you come back from the Olympics and, you kind of want to forget about it initially because you didn't do what you wanted to do. And to be fair, like, it's where the majority of the public would wake up to, say, certain Olympic sports. You know, it's where, say, athletics might come to the forefront of people's minds, whereas for the 3 years in between, it's kind of forgotten about. So the general public kind of wake up to all these other kind of minority sports that are now front and centre, which is fantastic. And, you know, for me, again, you're preparing for 4 years in advance for this moment. You want everything to go as planned. And like, sport is sport. Success is never a straight line. So you kind of, you know, when you come back from it, you kind of lick your wounds for a little bit. But then in time, you realise, you know, okay, well, what worked well? What did I do well? What were the areas that I could develop upon? And in my circumstances, 2009 turned out to be a good year, you know, and I went on from there. But again, this is the Olympic kind of the dream. This is what you want to aim for. And hopefully, you know, all of our athletes, 133 that are heading to Paris, will come back with great memories and great experiences and hopefully a few medals as well.
Yeah, think of them all at the moment, because they're in that anticipation bubble at the moment, aren't they?
Yeah.
Gráinne, I want to come to you. You're obviously our swimming. You were at the 2012 London Olympics, but you had illness, so you can be just very unlucky.
You can, and obviously I had a completely different experience to both David and Michael there, but I was sick going into the Games, obviously sick at the Games then, and swam the heat of the 400, but obviously knew that I wasn't up to 100%, and your health is your wealth at the end of the day, so had to pull out for the rest of the Games. And I think, slowly then kind of came back, fell out of love with sport, came back into the sport, which is a good sign. But I think everyone will have their ups and downs, and 2012 was obviously a very down for me.
You were fell out of love with the sport because it was glandular fever you had, was it?
It was glandular fever I had, so I got it about 2 months before the Games, and I thought that I could manage it best I could. In hindsight, when you're thinking back, obviously it's probably not the smartest move to do. You had good days and you had bad days, and I thought that I had a rhythm of like two good days, one bad day, and that my race would fall on a good day, and unfortunately, just the way the world worked, it wasn't a good day at all. That was my experience.
How long had you fallen out with the sport?
When I came home, obviously my health was the main important thing. And getting on top of everything. So I would have taken about a 4-month break from swimming, if like anything to do with it, and just trying to get back on top of feeling healthy and feeling myself, and then slowly came back involved in sport, probably about December time, went back down to my training base, which was Limerick at the time, with a new coach. And obviously that coach-athlete relationship is really, really important. And I think I found that really difficult as well. So that was another kind of challenge for me to settle back into the same program with a new coach. Mm-hmm. And then moved to France for a year. And I absolutely loved it. And I think it was the best thing I ever did, and retired on a high, yeah, even though my health wasn't 100%. But I think the experience that moving to France gave me was a good one, and made me kind of love swimming again.
You really set out how difficult it is, the ups and downs of sport, and you don't know what else has gone on in the background of your life that can change things. But it ended on a high, and you're in the right place now, looking at the swimmers, and we'll talk about those medal hopes in a second, Gráinne. But I want to come back. I'll come back to you, David, actually, because I want to talk about, you know, big names in athletics. We've legends of sport. You're there among them. Sonia O'Sullivan, of course, Dervla O'Rourke, Rob Heffernan. We're entering a new era, aren't we? A new and exciting era.
Yeah, well, like, you consider this summer, go back to Rome for the European Championships, our biggest medal haul, 2 gold, 2 silver. You know, the mixed relay, the women's 4x4 relay, and then obviously Ciara Magee and Rashida Adelecki in there as well. So I think when you look at going to a championship and winning medals, and not only just medals, there was a lot of good performances in there as well, people making finals, national records, personal best. Those are the performances you want to see at a major championships. And if you take that into account, the sport is in a really, really good place. And even, you know, when you go down to the ranks a little bit, you know, last weekend you had the European Under-18 Championships, which are taking place over in Slovakia. Ireland sent 35 athletes, came back with 5 medals. It's like, even that at underage is a huge success. So when you consider that, and then you look at what's happened at the senior level, you know, it is really, really in a good place, and the pipeline is strong, and that's what you want. But again, you know, the mood now shifts to the global championships, the world championships, and obviously this year you've got the Olympic Games. So mm-hmm. when you look at kind of, okay, well, where can the medals come from? You know, I think you're looking at both Ciara and Rashida to be the kind of leading lights in the individual events. It's going to be tough. It's going to be extremely tough. You know, Rashida in the 400 metres, you know, winning that silver in the Europeans, running a really fast time, 49.1, which was a time that would probably win and would have won the last number of World Championships, Europeans, and indeed Olympic Games. So when you consider that talent going into an Olympics, it's hugely exciting. Now, I have to kind of put the caveat in there. There was a Diamond League on in London over the weekend, and you had a Jamaican athlete, Price, came out and ran a 48.5, okay? So when you consider, you know, how fast that is, it's going to be tough. But that's what you expect at the Olympic level. So the relays are another option as well, but it's going to be quite tricky because of the schedule. So you have the mixed relay goes out first. But unfortunately, well, look, nothing is confirmed, but unfortunately that creates a bit of a headache for selectors, because obviously you have Rashida in the individual 400, which comes 2 days later. So, you know, that's up to her to decide. So, you know, priority would probably be the individual. Yeah. So that might see her forego the mixed early on. And then obviously if she goes well in her individual event, her final of the 400 metres is on the same day as the heats for the 4x4 relay team.
Oh, wow.
So you're kind of looking at a bit of a headache there again.
But that would be impossible, I presume.
It would be impossible now, to be honest with you. So there is strength and depth in that women's relay team. And obviously you have Charlene Maudsley and you have Sophie Becker qualified in the individual 400 as well.
Yes.
So, it's a bit of a headache, but again, look, you know, let's see how things pan out. And as I mentioned, Ciara Magee in the 1500 as well, the European champion. Now, the women's 1500 is such a strong event. You have plenty of talent in that, and it's going to be so close. But Ciara is a championship performer, as we all know, and hopefully she can do well. And Sarah Healy's in that also as well, who's going really well this season as well.
Ciara has the camogie finishing legs, as she said herself, doesn't she?
The legs and the elbows to find those gaps, you know, which is well needed in those events.
1500 metres. It's very exciting, though, at the same time. Gráinne, in swimming then, Daniel Whiffen, is that the main name we're looking out for?
Yeah, we've got a really strong team of swimmers heading over. Like, we've got the biggest team we've ever sent. So we obviously have Daniel Doan, which is one of our big, big hopes. And we all have Mona McSherry, who's also going. And then Ellen Walsh. So we've got quite a good good few kind of field going there. But yeah, I think everyone is looking at Daniel. Obviously, off the back of the year he's had, he's had a super year. He's in flying form. I was with him last week, and yeah, look, hopefully he holds it and goes out there and gets the job done. He's also adding the 10K to his kind of race plan now for next week. So once he finishes in this pool, he's going to do the open water 10K, which will be his first time ever doing it. But he does have like experience from the pool swimming, and he's been in the open water too. So that would be exciting to have our first ever open water swimmer at the Olympics as well.
Yeah, and Daniel Whitman, just to remind us, he won a double gold, didn't he, at the World Championships there a couple of months ago?
He did. He's a world record holder as well. So like all eyes are on him worldwide, not just in Ireland. People are like on his tails. There would have been a few countries missing from World Champs just because of timings with Olympic trials.
The Americans. The
preparation for Olympics. Yes, so they wouldn't have been there. So we are missing a few. Mm-hmm. And Daniel is a smart guy. He knows who's not there. He knows where they are. And he would have been following them over the last couple of months too. So it'll be a big kind of week for him, and a big 2 weeks kind of prepping now this week and then into racing.
You said you were with him only last week. Because he seems like a good attitude anytime you see him interviewed. He's full of confidence, isn't he? What was he like, his state of mind last week?
He's very confident. He is very, very confident, but he's also very clever of what he needs to do and when he needs to do it.
Yeah.
So he's very calm. He's looking forward to the Games, obviously second Olympics, so he has the experience of the first Olympics under his belt. He knows what to expect, even from like, people forget that when you go to the village, where the food hall is, how far away is the bus to get you to the venue. There is a lot of walking involved, which, you know, for as swimmers, that they won't be really used to. So he's introduced walking to his exercise, or to his, I suppose, training program over the last couple of months, just so that he's ahead of that, and all the swimmers have, to be fair. So
the minutiae of preparation is incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Every detail
corporate walking, yeah.
Yeah, every detail counts, because normally they would get out of their car at the pool, get their gym session done, into the water, and there will be very little walking, you know, that kind of way. Whereas when you get into the village, they could have to walk 1-2K minimum a day, which would affect obviously their preparation. So at least that's built in now, and their body is used to it.
I was going to ask you the most important thing about Daniel Whiffen. Is he from Armagh or Down? There's a discussion. There's a discussion about it. I'm going with Swim Ireland. They say he's from Armagh, so I presume. And his mother's people are from Kinsale, so they could claim him in Cork as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
But listen, thanks a million, Gráinne. Michael, we were talking about the minutiae there of preparations, all these little things you think about, where you're staying and what's going to happen on the day. And
yeah, well, like getting into the Olympic Village is obviously, it's very... you know, it's a rewarding thing as well that you've got there, you know. But there is a lot of, as you're talking about, like walking down to the canteens every day. There's a lot of walking in the Olympic Village. It would help us out in the sense that, you know, that we have to make weight every day when we're boxing. So every day that you box, you have to be on your weight. So you have to keep an eye on it as well. So we would do a lot of running in the Olympic Villages and skipping and things like that, just to moderate our weight and make sure that we're not overweight. So,
do you remember the opening ceremony? Because we were talking to Kelly Harrington here a couple of weeks ago, and she was saying this time she's going to focus on all of those moments, because she's total blank for the previous ones, because it's hard to concentrate when you're that excited, and the boxing is early in the
Every country walks in, you know, so that's a great moment, you know. So I got to do it twice in my lifetime, so and it's great that you're walking in with the whole team, you know, so not just the boxing team. So and I think Wayne McCullough was the flag bearer the first year that we went in 1988, and it was great. One of our boxers was holding the flag, you know. So,
and who did it in 92? Do you remember?
I can't remember. I think it was Michelle Smith.
Oh, it was Michelle Smith.
Yeah. I think so.
Who won all the medals in 96?
I carried the flag at the closing ceremony, so in 92.
Very good.
So when they closed the games.
For obvious reasons.
Yeah, for obvious
reasons. That must be a real special memory.
It's superb. You know, unbelievable. And you're looking at famous people beside you and you're going, wow.
I'm
in this gang now, I said, you know, so it was like that.
Because this, I think people are as excited about the opening ceremony as anything this week. The fact that it's going to be on a flotilla on the River Seine in Paris Friday.
I think it's going to be fantastic. And I think it's probably going to be one of our greatest Olympic Games.
Yeah.
Because like, you look at what you just mentioned on the show there, the amount of what we have here now, it's phenomenal.
And there's loads I haven't even mentioned. I've even mentioned the rowing, which is also very, that's next week as well. Paula Dunham and Fintan McCarthy, they're hoping, they're in the lightweight double skulls
hoping to be the first athletes to win gold medals back to back since Pat O'Callaghan, who was the hammer throw back in the day. Was it the 30s or 40s? I can't just remember offhand. But also Paula Donovan, he'd be the first Irish athlete to win medals in three games in a row, if he can do it this time. Yeah. Two more medals are predicted in rowing. Dara Lynch and Philip Doyle, there are some men's double sculls, and Afriku and Fiona in the women's pair. And I'd say, David, you're probably on top of the gymnastics a little bit more than the rest of us. Rhys McClenachan.
Oh, yeah, what a talent. World champion, European champion, going into Olympic Games. So this is like the medal that he doesn't have. And he was so unlucky in Tokyo. His routine on the pommel horse takes, I think he said about 45 seconds.
Yeah.
And in Tokyo, his thumb slipped.
That's
the margin. His thumb slipped, and then the knock-on consequences of that. So, but he's in, even on social media there, he's having the time of his life. He's testing out the beds and everything in the village. So he settled in. But he's in really, really good form. And I was doing a bit of work with him there recently enough. And again, the confidence is coming through. And I think he's definitely, definitely one to watch. And he'll medal, hopefully, and hopefully he'll be on top of the podium. And also, you mentioned the rowers there as well, but I think the rugby sevens are one to watch, the men's rugby sevens, which are actually kicking off next on Wednesday.
Wednesday,
time.
Yeah. And golf as well.
They're going really well. Golf, God, yeah, Lowry, McIlroy, Maguire, they're all there, it's a hugely exciting team. And again, I think, as Michael kind of referenced there, six is our best medal haul from London. So I think, we're hoping to better that at least and get as close to two figures as we can.
Wow, it's going to be a huge thing. Yeah. And Shane Lowry, he'll have some point to prove after the weekend where he was leading the Open. He finished sixth in the end, but he's very good at picking himself up and going. And the good thing, Michael, as well, is that we've a spread of people from all around the country this time, don't we?
Yeah, absolutely.
And north, south, bit of tip.
But it's going to be great watching other sports as well, rather than just watching your own sport, because, it can get somewhat boring sometimes as well that way. But it's going to be great watching all the others as well. And screaming at the telly as well, So that's what we all do.
We're all expert in the polo horse once every 4 years.
Yeah, exactly.
Keane O'Connor as well in equestrian. So I think we've nearly covered absolutely everything there. It is a massively exciting time.
It's unbelievable, and you have to say fair play to all the. The Spartan bodies who've come in here and helped these people as well. Obviously Sport Ireland is a great thing as well. We got great coaches in our boxing team as well, so it's looking really good for us all. Now the next part of that is nerves get to everybody, so you have to hold yourself on that moment and push yourself a little bit harder as well. So we're hoping that they don't fall at the last hurdle for the want of better words.
And we're going to enjoy it. Listen, Gráinne Murphy, thank you so much, Gráinne. You're going to be on pundit duty for us on RT with the swimming. And David Gillick, he's also going to be doing the business for athletics. Thank you both so much. And Michael Carruth, Olympic gold champion. Thanks a million for being
here. Thanks for having me.
We'll be back after these.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.
Okay, welcome back. My next guest started cleaning mansions, but she's moved into a more challenging speciality, from sorting out the homes of hoarders to cleaning up what are called trauma scenes. Now, these are crime scenes. These are literally places where sometimes murders have happened and other deaths as well. So at this point, I want to give you the warning that this could be a difficult subject matter for some people, so your listener discretion is advised. But I don't want to put you off entirely from our guest, a fascinating guest, Alana Gillen. You're very welcome. Your job is absolutely incredible. I didn't know your job existed.
Well, that's the thing. You don't know that I exist until you need me.
Is there a name, a particular technical name on your job?
I would describe it as a sort of an umbrella term of biohazard crime scene and trauma cleaning, and sort of all the things that fall underneath that.
Yeah. And it's a really difficult job, trauma cleaning. Who hires you then?
So it can be anyone from family members, neighbours, anyone that owns property. If it's a scene that has happened, say there's an accident has happened in a community, place, then it's sort of facilities management. So it can be anybody really that needs a service.
Workplaces and so on. Yeah, so anything where blood has been spilled, really, isn't it? Because that's absolutely where you're a specialist. Yeah. How do you get into something, an area like this? Because it is specialised and there is a technical skill and education required, I presume.
Yes, I always tell people that it was a series of unfortunate events that led me to to where I am today. But yes, I did have to go and get qualified and different courses and things and just have a general interest. But I built up from having a domestic cleaning company, first of all, and got very bored cleaning and dusting ornaments and in the same place.
There was a big mansion, big houses.
Yes, and small houses too. I did one bedroom flats to seven bedroom mansions with swimming pools and their own private bars. All very boring.
That's not boring at all. I'd love to snoop around people's mansions and see how they live and judge them on where all the filth is.
It has always just reassured me that I do not want a big house.
Is that right? Okay.
I don't want to have to clean
because
all
of
that.
The cleaning, or even having to pay someone to clean it.
That's it.
Or probably just not use. It probably rooms you were dusting out
from. Yeah, absolutely. You have big, massive houses that people never go into rooms and it's always, that's the good room or that's the party room or that's the seven spare bedrooms that's never ever used, but you're cleaning it every week anyway.
Oh my God. And all over the country.
All over the country.
So, and that came out of, I think you were you working in restaurants and then the crash happened?
Yeah, absolutely. I was worked in hospitality from I was about 14, 15, washing dishes, serving tables, worked my way up to a restaurant manager, and the crash happened in 2012 and sort of realised.
But you were a get up and go get at it, aren't you? So you set up your own cleaning company.
Two children and bills to pay, so it was a case of sink or swim, and it was there wasn't any jobs, and I sort of really started to panic of what can I do, and I was like, I'm not bad at cleaning, maybe give that a go.
And where did you go? Because you obviously were sick and tired of cleaning these empty mansions. Where did the idea of becoming the trauma scene cleaner come from?
So in 2017, a book came out called The Trauma Cleaner, and it was a lady in Australia, Sandra Pankhurst, who had set up a trauma cleaning company. Yeah. She was married to an undertaker and realised that there was no one to actually clean up after the deaths, and I was fascinated by her book, and I suppose that was my light bulb moment. Although I do have a best friend whose partner says that he gave me the idea, although I can never remember that conversation, but he still swears that it was his
success
idea.
Success has many fathers, yeah.
So, but it was really, it was a book, and it was a crossroads of the cleaning company. I was bored and didn't really know what else to do. I wanted to go in a different direction, and I thought about coming away from the cleaning industry altogether. But once I'd read that book, I knew that was my calling.
This got you interested, and it requires a calling because, as you mentioned, it's biohazard and trauma scene cleaning. What's the training like for this?
So there's different types of training. I've done two sets of training. I went to Nelson and Clone College in Manchester, first of all, and I did some City and Guilds training in biohazard crime scene and trauma cleaning, and that covered everything from IV needle sweeps to fogging long before COVID arrived, and that was
that kills everything.
Yeah, so we were trained in that there, and then in 2021 I decided to go to Ultima Cleaning in Bristol. They're actually based in Wales, but their college, their academy is in Bristol.
Yeah,
and I got trained up with them for 3 days just to reassure myself that I was doing the right thing and sort of what I'd been taught before was still relevant. And up to date, and I'll probably look into something else again soon, but I try to do different courses and keep up to date quite regularly.
So it's a serious job, because obviously you're cleaning up after you're cleaning up disturbing scenes where someone has died. You're dealing with the bereaved families as well. So if in the case of just what we'd call a normal death, I suppose, the funeral directors have come in, they've removed the body, there is still cleanup always to be required there. But I presume when crime has occurred and there is blood, that's when it gets very tough? Yeah.
So crime scene cleaning, again, is an umbrella term. So that's anything that kind of involves body fluid cleanup. It doesn't necessarily have to be a murder. It can also be a break-in or domestic violence, things like that there, which can lead to body fluids needing cleaned up in certain scenes. Not everyone gets the privilege of passing away peacefully in bed. And sometimes deaths can be quite traumatic. Sometimes people aren't found. And it's the length of time or what has happened before that. And it's not just blood, it could be decomposition and things like that there. So it's really important that you have a professional or a specialist to come in and clean that up and not attempt to do that yourselves. And families shouldn't have to do that themselves
they
either.
They shouldn't, no. Because obviously it's a biohazard. It's dangerous for people, isn't it? So you need to be
absolutely
equipped.
It would be classified as potentially hazardous waste. So even transporting that there, you have to have licenses and paperwork to follow all that up. It's not a case of giving it away a spray with some bleach and hoping for the best.
Yeah.
So it's quite important.
Your job is reassuring in that regard. But the difficult part for you, and I don't know what the training was like, because you're going into a house where sort of the official people of the state have kind of left at this stage, haven't they? I mean, there is a crime, forensics, their job is all done and everything. Yep. But the fluids are left behind, as you've put it. How do you deal with the families when you meet them at the doorstep?
So I have a great sense of empathy and just being able to chat to people and listen to them. I have cried with mummies. I have hugged people, you know, and I love that side of my job because I'm so genuine and I'm hurt for that person as well of what has happened to them. Sometimes I have come across men who have found their brother they haven't found them in a couple of weeks and they've just discovered their body and they're so upset and they blame themselves and they're angry or they're, you know, they've got this guilt and it's just listening to their story before you even put that forensics on, before you even enter the house. You know, they need to tell you.
Is that right?
Their story.
They want to talk to you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's all part of it, not just going in and cleaning up, you know. And
yeah, no, it's a huge part of it.
And it's listening. And, you know, if a person needs a hug, I'm all for that. And I will cry with people. I have cried with people. Really? I'm such a softy.
I can see you're that kind of person. And then after all of that, you have to go and clean the scene.
And that's when sort of the task of, right, this is my job, you know, that bit clicks in. Then this is work now and you have to be professional. You put that suit on and you have to make sure your PP is correct. You have to make sure that all the procedures that you're doing is correct so you can sort of leave that personal touch at the door and pick that up again when you go
and
to
and
speak.
You've explained to them what you're about to do.
And
well,
I always encourage them to kind of leave at that stage because they don't need to see me in a forensic suit. They don't need to see what's coming out of my cases to deal with sort of whatever's in front of
them. That's lovely that you take that care because obviously when you dress up you're fully covered, are you? And it can be a scary looking
and
costume.
You know, it's such a traumatic thing to start off with. You don't need to have that visual there as well.
PPE clothing.
Yeah, you're dealing with the visuals of death. You're dealing with the smells as well. Mm-hmm. And some people that have been in the house, they don't want to return into the house. You know, they can't face that.
Yes,
And I've even been asked to go in and collect the shirt and tie from the wardrobe or look for a certain item of jewellery.
Right.
And I will do that for people. And I love doing that. You know, it's a great part of my job satisfaction that I've been helpful, that I've been useful, that I've been able to do that for someone.
You want people to be at peace, I suppose, in the area of your work. On the practical level then, how does one clean things like blood and bodily fluids?
Hard work.
Yeah.
There's no magic trick. We obviously have correct chemicals. There's special enzymes and things like that. There's ozone machines. There's different equipment for different situations.
It's science-driven.
Science-driven, which has always been exciting for me. And I suppose years of my teachers pulling their hair out of me doing double award science for GCSE, it finally clicked in somewhere.
Very good. What's an ozone machine?
Ozone machine is a machine that deals with odour. Electrically
charges
oxygen molecules and it puts out unstable oxygen molecules. And then as that stabilises, it removes the odour and the bacteria. back in as, wow. as it stabilises.
Makes it easier for you to do your job as well.
Yeah, so it replaces, and now it does leave quite a strong chemical smell afterwards.
Right, but better
it's better than the smell.
What's a forensic torch?
So the forensic torch is basically to reassure me that I've done my job properly, and that's not really for anyone else. I can go around with my special glasses and my little torch, and I can see all manner of things. But as long as I have
okay, so that's the show the kind of. Stains and things, and that
shows body fluids.
You want to see that clear at the end.
Yep, and I'm not really too worried if there's anything else anywhere else, just in the area that I have.
The place that your job is done. Yes, as I say, you see some terrible trauma in the aftermath of that, and you told us you cry sometimes. The families, you must carry a lot of this away with you when you leave.
It's hard not to. Certainly I've dealt with situations where there has been young males that have committed suicide and you know, they've got mums and stuff there, and I'm a parent, and I know that, like, that situation that you never want to be in. So you can't have this hard face. You can't, you know, not be affected by it. But at the same time, of years of being in that job, you do get desensitised, but I'm always aware not to be too desensitised to a sensitive situation, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yes, it does, yeah.
So you have to have that kind of soft nature to kind of deal with it, but you can't be too soft that it would ultimately affect your own mental health.
Are you going in with a team, or are you...
Sometimes, but 95% of the time it's myself.
That's how sensitive it is, really, just one
yeah,
person.
And I feel that I can provide a better service one-on-one going in. You know, you don't have a massive team coming in. You don't have all these people stumping around, you know, your son's room or your brother's bedroom or, you know, your wee granny's hall, which is maybe falling down the stairs. You don't need, you know, four or five people in doing that. And if it takes me half a day by myself, then I'll make sure that that's done and that's the case.
It's incredible. Your work is unbelievable. How old are your own kids now?
19 today for my son.
Oh my God. Happy
and
birthday there.
My daughter is 17.
17. So with teenage kids, you know only too well, you can empathise with parents, you know, because it's a mental illness. It's
absolutely
a disease, really, in the country that leads to death by suicide. I mean, it
absolutely
is enormously difficult.
Absolutely. And you sort of in my job, you're very aware of it. And it's the same if I've been called out to, say, some squat and squalor situations where there's been drug use or there's needles and things there as well.
Okay,
I'm so aware of the other side of sort of the underbelly of the world, and sort of coming home and you're constantly kind of drumming that into the kids, you know, this is what I saw today, trying to keep them the right track and not traumatise them.
It is a delicate balance, isn't it? Yeah, because there are addiction issues or illnesses out there, and you're confronted them like a lot of frontline workers, I suppose, in a way.
Absolutely,
seeing the real world.
Yeah, and I come in after those guys, so I suppose the emergency services, they see a lot worse than what I do. I'm just cleaning up the aftermath of it.
It can be worse though for you because you're kind of imagining it, aren't you?
That's it. You're kind of piecing together your own story from it. So I suppose I like to think I'm a little bit of a detective now and again.
I wonder about that because we know about forensics and people are obsessed with, you know, photographing a blood splatter and the incredible story that they can tell and how important that is when it comes to, you know, putting justice into action. Are bloodstains removable, by the way?
From certain materials and things, and it depends. There's many, many factors, you know, how long it has been there for, how much is there, where it has come from as well, what part of the body has come from, and things like that there. So, so it just depends on the surfaces and things, what chemicals you can use to break down that compound and kind of remove it, or if it's just to the stage where it's too contaminated and it can't be cleaned properly or safely.
Without leaving some trace behind.
Yeah,
okay.
So in that case then I would remove things, and sometimes you sort of think to yourself that you've kind of, you've removed the personality of someone's home, If there's if there's like an area or something you've had to cut carpet, or you've had to, you know, remove a sofa, or you know, you've had to cut a bit of wood out of the sort of skirting boards and things like that there.
I see.
Sometimes that in itself can kind of be quite shocking for someone to come back into.
Find a piece missing, yeah.
So we,
and as a cleaner, is that your job as well to do that?
Yeah, oh absolutely. Because it's contaminated. Mm, so it's okay. It's my job to make sure that there is no contamination
and
left
disposed
at all.
Of in
the, disposed of.
The licensed way that you mentioned.
Absolutely. And then we have a lovely team of painters and joiners and everybody else that comes in behind that can fix those if the families wish it. Or sometimes it's a case of it's a landlord, you know, and there is no family and the sort of the house has to be put back right for the next tenant that's coming
in. Yeah, and in hopes that they don't know what's happened, isn't that
it? Well, if I've done my job right, they won't know.
They won't know. Talk to us about hoarders, because that's another area of a specialised area as well of yours too. And we see all the stuff on newspapers and on the telly about hoarders. You don't think that's a proper illustration of what goes on?
Not at all. Sometimes I get quite frustrated with sort of how it's portrayed on TV, and I wish it could be done in 3 days and all of a sudden everything's painted white and it's over and done with. I have clients that I could be working with for 3 weeks. I have clients I've been working with for 2 years, 3 years, and it's just breaking down those barriers. And a lot of it is trauma related as well. There's triggers there, you're working through that. A lot of the people that I've worked with, they're obviously suffering with different mental health disorders, conditions, and there's reasons behind everything. And I hate the fact that people think it's just laziness, it's definitely not. And I have a wee saying that you know, mess is morally neutral. It doesn't make you a good person or a bad person just because you can clean your house.
Tidy house does not denote
it really, really
moral
doesn't.
Goodness.
Exactly. And shame is the enemy of function. So whenever you're hiding in your home and you're hiding things from friends and families, it paralyzes you as well. And that overwhelmness, it spirals out of control and it freezes you. And I would describe a lot of my clients as being comfortably numb.
Right, yes.
And it's just, you talk about clutter blindness. So, you know, you've got loads of things sitting on your desk and eventually you don't see that. And that kind of does happen in home as well. Like your brain is blocking those things out because it's trying to like help you. It's trying to protect you from your own surroundings. But then it eventually does the opposite, where you no longer realise how bad your surroundings are, and it's affecting not only your mental health but your actual physical health. And a lot of people end up very sick because of the conditions. You know, there's rotten food, there could be pests.
When you were involved, and I presume you're being referred to by psychologists or people involved in mental health?
So yes, the mental health teams can sort of give me a call and they make a referral, and we have like a lovely little document that they fill out, and we sort of check boxes and sort of make sure that they're on the our sort of criteria. We don't go in and just
arrive one day. So a lot of issues have to be worked through, obviously.
Absolutely. And sometimes for those people, I could be the first person inside their home in years. You know, they've stopped the social workers coming in, or you know, and it's just breaking down those barriers of I'm not the enemy, and I'm not going to just randomly throw all your stuff out. And I always try and get some of the people to do a little exercise. You know, people ask me, oh, how does that happen? Or can you not just go in and throw it all away? And I always get people to think, if I went into your bedroom right now and completely took everything out of it, all your personal items, your pictures, your jewellery, anything that made any sort of sentimental value to you, and took it all away because it didn't mean anything to me and it's just clutter, you wouldn't be very happy, would you?
No, with the stuff that tells somebody's story.
So just because their whole house is completely filled with stuff, you know, rubbish, collectibles, just random things, it doesn't mean that they don't have any attachment to that. There's a reason that that's there, and it's about breaking down those reasons and finding out, right, well, what can we do with this? Things, what should we do with this? And letting them know that they deserve to live in a better condition as well, yeah, to keep themselves healthy.
So by the time you arrive, they're sort of open to this. Is it a very slow process to take apart?
Very slow process. Some people that I would be with, it could take them months to even let me in the door. We can have little chats on the doorstep, we can have chats over the phone. Usually by the time they come to me, it's the end of the line. So they could be facing eviction, they could be facing different sort of bodies, like environmental health, you know, would be pushing for certain things, and they're coming to me. It's like, this is the last stop. I'm here to help, or further actions going. So, but what we're trying to do, what I'm trying to do in campaign over the last couple of years, is to make me not the last stop, to get me further up the chain.
I see, yeah,
to try,
yeah,
and help people before it gets to the...
Because by the sounds of things, we've come to know you over the last 20 minutes or so, that you're like a therapist yourself.
Yes.
You would have been an amazing therapist, by the way.
Thank you very much.
You would have been so good at that.
You have to be a chameleon. You have to blend into all situations, and you have to find that common ground and have a chat with people and kind of, you know, get on that one-to-one. But no qualifications in that area, although I did recently, I went on to Open University, and I've just completed a wee course in trauma and just counselling.
Wow.
And that's my first step to actually putting some of my nonsense into paperwork.
It's not nonsense, you've something more important, which is the experience of chatting to people.
That's it. And just having the paperwork to back that up, to know that I'm not doing any more damage.
You love your job.
I absolutely love my job. I couldn't be happier. And I know it's sort of grim in places, but I don't ever see it that there. I have such great job satisfaction and genuinely getting to help people in the worst possible situations.
Absolutely, yeah. Because it seems grim, but I mean, it's like, you know, a surgeon's job can be grim, but they're doing good things for people and nurses and so on. And that's, you're just part of that whole chain, which gives us kind of faith sometimes, isn't it? Because there are good people out there who want to help.
That's in bad situations. There's a whole host of people that will be involved in the situations before me. But I just kind of think, because I am the last stop, if I'm the last person and I can help and sort of make it better, then they're going on to face further sort of heartache or whatever. But I've made that small bit better and I've been able to fix a little bit for them,
yeah,
I suppose.
Alana Gillan, we now know what a biohazard and trauma cleaner is. Are you cleaning today, by the way?
I'm going to go and clean my granny's house today.
Who's very much alive. And
yes.
So this is something you have to do.
I've been on holiday for 2 weeks and she's not impressed that the dustbin won't do itself. So I have a VIP guest booked in this afternoon.
So you're obviously brilliant still at the regular cleaning.
She's very good at humbling me.
She doesn't insist on an ozone machine.
No, but if I don't get the lines in the carpet right, I'll definitely hear about it.
Alana, it's an absolute pleasure. Thanks for coming in to chat to us today.
Thank you so much.
And continue enjoying your job. It's always good to meet someone who loves their job.
Thank you.
Look after yourself. 51551, that's our text.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.
Now, welcome back. Since March, as you'll know, a protest camp has been in place outside the former Crown Paints factory site in Coolock in North Dublin. The protesters, they oppose a plan to use a large warehouse as accommodation for international protection applicants or asylum seekers. Last week, those protests significantly escalated. Machinery and pallets were set alight, causing a very large fire. More than 200 Gardaí were deployed. 3 Garda cars were damaged, one of which was set on fire. Pepper spray was used by Gardaí because a security guard and a number of Gardaí themselves were injured during clashes with protesters. Petrol bombs and fireworks were thrown. Gardaí have described the disturbances as a public order incident. The road was closed for a period. And since then, there have been 4 fires in the building in the last 4 nights. And a 5th fire last Monday saw a digger and mattresses targeted. These are all suspected arson attacks. Gardaí have also been seizing petrol bombs following searches near the former Crown Paints warehouse, and there's no end in sight for this violence. I'm joined in the studio now by Coolock resident George Finglas. You're very welcome, George.
Thank you, and
thanks so much for writing into us. You sent us an email kind of highlighting what you're experiencing because you live right next to the site where all this trouble is happening.
Yeah, I live within 200 yards of the site, and things have changed for not only myself, the residents of the all the surrounding areas. It's turning into a no-go area down here in the sense of when the issues are happening on the Malahide Road and the public order unit have to move in, crowds then begin to scatter. Mm-hmm. And then they scatter and they're coming down the likes of my road and all the surrounding roads.
That's where they go.
Okay. They have to get out of the firing line because I don't know what people are saying. There's pepper spray being used and at, we say, the heart of the situation. Mm-hmm. But the reality for me is, the fallout is that my peaceful existence is now being interfered with. I find I have to lock me gates.
And you're a retired man.
I'm retired.
And
I'm 71.
You know this area for decades. You've been living there decades.
I was born in Donnycarney. I moved to Aidenmore and I live in Coolock, all within the barony of Coolock, the name that's been dragged through the mire all my life. So in other words, yes, I'm a local man and I know the area well.
And love the place.
I absolutely love it.
And your peaceful existence there is ripped apart.
It's certainly changing, and it has changed since the Monday the 15th. In the sense of, on the particular Monday, I have helicopters in the sky. The noise, it makes me imagine what would have happened in other countries. Something, and I'm in my own home, and I'm looking up at this, and all of a sudden, then I'm out the front, and I see gangs coming down, pulling up bins on neighbours, and I'm finding that I need to lock my gates, pull my bins into the, and then get a golf club in behind the door because it'll protect me property.
Really,
and that's the way it's been all week. It's been up to last Friday, it was particularly heightened because there was different issues every night. It seems to have quieted down a bit since then.
Yeah,
I don't want to inflame anything or I don't want to presume anything, but I just hope. But
your email to us really described there was a real sense of fear that you're living.
Absolutely. My simple, peaceful living in my home, my safe place.
You have a golf club, you know, behind your front door.
I have a golf club behind my front door because I felt the need that if somebody's going to interfere, you know, I park my car a certain way that the people won't see the registration or if
what's your thinking there?
Thinking that if somebody's going to throw a brick, it might go through the side window as opposed to the windscreen. Things like that, wow, you know, yeah. like it's it's, I don't know, maybe it's naivety, but the point is that it's protection as well. I'm trying to protect me home. I think my gates were closed for the first time in I can't remember, because they were seized, but because they're usually left open all the time. But I felt that I had to close them, pulled the bins in.
They're pulling the wheelie bins out and they've set some on fire in the middle of the road.
Doing damage with them as well.
I was just about to say, the Irish Independent reported somebody was actually attacked when they tried to stop their bin. So that's the sort of atmosphere.
This is the problem. And then there's damage being done to property and cars in the area. And, you know, the ordinary people, we didn't vote for that. And there's a huge issue in the sense of just one night after the other. And I'm saying, where's the dialogue? Why isn't there dialogue? Why aren't they sitting down with the parties, the vested parties, and getting to the next stage? We just had it with the Aer Lingus strike, and we said it all along. It would end when there was dialogue. Mm-hmm. And it did. And that's what happens. But it seems to be lacking here. I don't know what it costs. It's probably costing a million a night. I don't know. But the point about it is the services in the likes of the area, like, is very much lacking. I have a lot of, you know, my involvement, say, with community in the area would be I'm a spokesperson for local men's shed. And, you know, I see an awful lot of the issues and hear from fathers and grandfathers the issues for their children, whether it be football. I speaking only last week to two lads from local football club, John Vianney's and
John Vianney Football Club.
Football club, yeah. And they have
300 kids.
300 kids, 17 teams, and they got one Port-a-Loo. And I'm saying to them at a meeting, these are the heroes of the the whole thing here, because they're volunteers that's looking after these kids, yeah. trying to keep them on the straight and narrow. And the guy from Kilmore Celtic says, well, at least they have a Portaloo. We've none.
Kilmore Celtic. They've no toilets.
They haven't got a toilet.
But these are simple things.
It's simple, but yeah. the likes of the services, like even our own pitch and puck club, we use the local up in Priorswood. We'd use the local pitch and puck club. The grass is 6 foot tall. Why? Because they've no money to cut the grass. And like these are the issues, on-ground issues. There's everybody you speak to will tell you that their projects are suffering. All the funding is down. And, you know, like, I just feel that there's a possibility if they get their heads together on the basis of what's to happen next in Crown Paint, maybe dialogue will put that to something for both. The community needs so much. Yeah. Maybe they could, if they sat down and talked, that there could be something. If I don't know, I don't want to preempt what's going in.
But there's sort of two issues going on, isn't there? Because you've described there the lack of public services in areas like Coolock.
Absolutely.
The neglected places.
Absolutely.
And that creates a residual anger.
Yeah.
And when it flares up, you'll have people who'll come out and take advantage of that, but also will express their anger in the violent way that we've seen. The other thing you're talking about is dialogue. Now, you have a very interesting story which you wrote to us about as well. Were you at your local bus stop? Tell us what happened.
Yeah, last Friday evening at approximately 8:30, I went to get the bus heading towards the N6. It's just on the Tunnagy Road. It's less than 2 minutes from my door. And I went up to the bus stop. It was certainly kicking off another 200 yards. I couldn't actually see the Malahide Road, but okay. I could see the people spilling out, and I saw young lads on scooters. I saw police cars melting the curb, trying to chase them, running down the lads on the scooters, going in and out my estate. There's no way the police were going to catch them.
No.
But you knew that there was something wrong. And then a lad came, a baseball cap, and his eyes were all red. And he looked a bit distressed, and he said to me, "I might have been pepper sprayed." And I done the usual, the fatherly, grandfatherly advice, and said it to him, "You're absolutely mad going near that. Yeah. Somebody's going to be killed." And then soon after, then another lad, he was black, came, and he was standing. We were all waiting on the bus, and a few minutes after, no bus, we all got apps together, bus cancelled, no doubt due to the disturbance. Mm-hmm. So I decided, well, look, I needed to get to where I was going to. I decided I'd go back and get the car. But I said to the two lads, listen, if you want the lift, where are you going to? I'm going up to Towers Paul Mellon Hospital. The other lad said, I'm going to Santry. Well, I said, I'm going in between there. If you want to wait, I'll give you a lift.
So this tells us who you are in particular. You pick up two lads.
Two strangers.
Two strangers.
And these are the guys at the bus stop. And I said to them, wait over there. And when I come up, I see the two of them talking. Now, I said to myself, well, like, one guy is the baseball cap and he was coming with out, in other words, to join the protest.
Yeah, he was coming from an anti-immigration protest.
The other guy I know is a nurse after finishing a long shift. Yeah. I didn't particularly know anything about either of these two individuals. But I had a coat in the back of the car, I took it up, put it in the front because I wanted the two of them to sit. This is my social experiment.
you conducted your own experiment.
On the way up the road. But anyway, the two lads sat in the car and I let them, I was listening to them, they were chatting away and they were very much asking each other about backgrounds and where you're from and the whole lot. And they actually shook hands getting out. And they both offered me money. And I said, no, just pay a good deal forward. But anyway, I dropped
you
one.
Said, do the good deed.
Just pay a good deal forward. That the good deed that I'd done for you, you pay it forward to somebody else. That's my style anyway. I dropped one at Bowman Hospital and the other then near enough to Santry, so we hadn't too far to walk.
What a story, though.
And,
the whole point is they were just...
Dialogue.
They were just chatting.
They got talking.
Discovered each other's lives.
And, see, one other thing I have to say, Oliver, I was at the meeting in Kish House in my capacity as a representative of the men's shed. And every single TD, the whole of North Dublin was represented. Every TD and councillor and elected representative to a man and woman said they needed an awful lot more information to bring back to their constituents regarding...
You're talking about the Department of Integration meeting in March. Which was...
Roger O'Gorman was on, giving a report during the week, basically stating what happened.
That he said there was sufficient engagement.
He said it did not happen. Certainly, I wouldn't necessarily say that if there was, that I should have been involved. That's not what I'm saying. Because I speak to a lot of the people who were at that meeting, and they told me, sure, we only found out on the 15th ourselves. So in other words, it didn't happen. Community was in shock. Mm-hmm. It, all of a sudden, then we're out into, like, there was a bulldozer driven in. And like it's a beautiful area. Their name getting dragged through the mud. It's so sad.
It is, yeah.
And I'm urging, the reason I'm in here is to urge that dialogue, that they get around the table and they come to some form of compromise and let people get on with their peaceful living. That I don't have to need a golf club in behind me door. That
absolutely
I can walk
not.
Me dog.
Yeah.
I can't.
Yeah. You can't walk your dog at the moment.
With the shops closed. Once the buses are, this has been a regular thing. Once there's sign of trouble, you have to understand the busmen. I really pity the Gardaí. Oh, they're absolutely brilliant. I mean, Let's face it. If we're in trouble, who are we going to ring? It's
of course,
them.
Yeah.
And you know, like.
And actually, I want to say on that note,
they're in the third line.
We spoke to two guards here, who spent their career. They spent 7 years working in Coolock. Garda Gerhard Keller and Garda Sergeant Chris O'Shaughnessy. And they're now in Darndale and they use soccer to connect with the teenagers at risk of falling into crime. So they're involved in that as well. So they do an amazing job from that point of view as well. The dialogue you're talking about, because people will say, look at, there are anti-immigration protests. They're online. They're very charged. They're using American language. They borrowed it from the far right over there. We can never really converse with those people because they've sort of gone from us. You're talking about the middle ground, really, aren't you?
I'm talking about the ordinary, decent people of Coolock, the community, the elected representatives and the proper community leaders who have a stake, who can represent their community where they live and the issues that face them down.
What can the Department of Integration do to get those middle ground people on board? Because ultimately it's about bringing 500 asylum seekers into this warehouse that they want to convert. They're not able to do it because of all the trouble. What do you think they could do to make it okay with the community for those 500 people to come and live there temporarily?
Well, I think you say 500 people. Again, I wouldn't be part of the negotiating team, but if they sit down and talk, maybe that number might change, and maybe services that they're providing for people in there, that if they were provided the same for the community, could be a little bit, we'll call it give and take. In other words, there's a chance that if there's something in it for the community, buy in. Maybe there's an audit to be done in the whole country and see who's doing what for where, who's doing nothing. Maybe they can do a little bit. And I'm not talking about putting large 500 reception centres in every area. Maybe it could be relieved by areas that are not doing anything, by doing a little and taking the pressure off. Mm-hmm. Coolock, I do know, they have a homeless hub and they're very much in the forefront.
And nobody's ever protested outside.
No,
a
but the point about it is that
emergency accommodation for homeless Irish people, there's never been a protest there.
Well, you say homeless and Irish people. I don't think that's been an issue in the sense of their nationality.
No, it hasn't.
For,
no, fairness.
And
you're dead right.
To be fair.
Yeah, you're 100%.
You know, but they have.
What I mean to say is when the Department of Housing announces emergency accommodation for what we call the homeless, there's never been a protest. Suddenly when we create, when we mention international protection applicants, then you get the kind of
the other thing,
the dark
I know
side of the internet.
It's never going to be sorted unless they get around the table.
It's a conversation.
It's a conversation. Is it
I
right?
thought it was something interesting. Keane O'Callaghan, he's a Social Democrat. That's in the opposition, obviously. He says there's a lack of engagement there. And I thought it was very interesting. He says he thinks that we'll put an end to the violent protests because people with the more extreme positions would be isolated. So the moment the numbers look big, because you've got that middle ground that you think they need to talk to, are kind of swelling the numbers because they're at the fringes of the protests and they're concerned because there's a gap of information.
I think what happens is
the protests, the violent ones, are quite, it's a very, very small number. And if they're isolated out, it's easy to take.
But what they would do, for obvious reasons, is they'd mix in between and you'd think the whole. I think that's why a lot of decent people from the area are hurt. They're getting a bad press because it looks like if there's 10 of us in a corner and there's one planted in between and that's the person that throws the bottle, it looks like the rest of us are involved.
Yeah.
And they're not. They're there to protect their their way of life.
They're expressing concern.
They're expressing concern.
In a peaceful way.
Peaceful, very peaceful.
Yeah. They're tarnished with the same way. You were at that meeting then. How many meetings have you had with the Department of Integration, or have you been at those?
Only at the one as I said, in my capacity as a spokesperson for the men's shed. I did speak at it myself. I did express my concerns in the sense of what it meant to me personally. But I heard very clearly that every single TD to a man and a woman wanted a lot more information to bring to the constituents, and it never happened. It never happened. Roger O'Gorman said it did. I'm telling you, it didn't.
And that is what Kina Callan is also saying, that the department thinks that what they did, that meeting, was a good effort, community engagement. I don't think it's credible. It's only the start of community engagement rather than the end point.
Absolutely.
It just needs to be more.
You need to get and speak to the interested parties around the table and see, as I said, like the Aer Lingus dispute, it sorted. But it was dialogue that sorted it. And there's no dialogue at the moment. And we have been quite peaceful there last night and Sunday and Saturday. I sort of monitor. I'm sort of fearful to go out. I had them sort of tied to my house. I'm fearful that something's going to kick off. So certain things I've had to cancel just to be around. I told you what happened on Friday.
Yeah.
No buses, shops closed all of a sudden like that. No notice. Lucky we had an app, but the point is that I pity a lot of the people that, I took pity on the two guys, was able to accommodate them. What about the thousands of others that...
who can't travel, that do the simple
journeys? Well, probably have to walk home after hard day's work. They're all the issues.
What is it like at night? Are you able to sleep okay? Do you feel...
just nervous that something's going to kick off. Always, I find myself, I'm watching a program and I can't remember what it's about because I'm going to the curtains a lot and I'm going looking at the blinds. I'm wondering, is something going to kick off? It makes you nervous and it shouldn't be like that in your own home.
I just want to, just because there's a statement from the Department of Integration which they gave to the Journal, and it's about the ongoing engagement they have. They're claiming they have ongoing engagement with local representatives. They've also met with the Northside Community Forum, which includes 75 community groups, and the Northside Partnership and community development organisations working in areas of anti-poverty, addiction, supports and integration. That's what they're saying.
No, but that's the meeting that was held on. That's the meeting that was held on the 8th of April in Kish House. Okay. That I was at.
Yeah, they're just saying...
No, but that's it. But there wasn't one since.
The department is saying that it's ongoing.
Like, ongoing is right. That's the thing. But they, I think they started the process before the ongoing.
George, tell me about the Coolock that you know before all of this became an issue.
Oh, it's beautiful, beautiful. The people are the best. Salt of the earth everywhere across it. You know, for obvious reasons, the last 43 years, they came through a terrible time in the sense of trying to support the Stardust. Yeah. Lots of them are personal friends. I lost a schoolmate, Morty Kavanagh, Lord rest him. I always remember him all the time. Because the personalisation of, you say, the tragedy of that. Yeah. I went to a lot of the funerals and personal friends with... many of the people, that's what happens. You can see the support in the area for them and the respect.
And story highlights the neglect of the establishment towards Coolock and the likes of Coolock for 4 decades.
We've been through that. You can see in the sense that the unlawful killing verdict, that the relief it gave, and how, it was as hard fought for as Hillsborough was, in other words, fighting against an injustice.
And I think it also highlights how close Coolock people are to each other.
Exactly, and it showed how close they are. You meet any of these people, the whole lot, and the first thing you get is a hug, and that's genuine, they're really wonderful people. And there's nothing they wouldn't do, and you there's lots of stuff happening that don't often happen on Facebook or on freebies or whatever. They'll get together and they'll get someone that's had a bit of a problem and they'll sort him out. And, really salt of the earth, really good people. And it's so sad to see that, a lot of what people have worked through getting dragged through the mire. I'm really hurt over that. Mm-hmm. I absolutely idolise. I love where I'm living. I'll never move. But there again, this peaceful existence that I thought, this utopia, especially in my retirement. And I just feel that it's I don't know what's going to happen during the week.
Yeah.
What's happening next? Yeah. That's the worry for me.
There's also a huge catch 22 now for the government, because if the accommodation doesn't go ahead for the asylum seekers, they'll have seen to capitulate to the violent protests. And if it does go ahead, it could just lead to ongoing...
But what you just said there is black and white. Let's get the grey. Let's see what can go ahead.
Discussion.
You know, discussion. Let's see what can go ahead,
In chatting to the good people of Coolock and the good and decent people, what is their view of immigrants coming to live there?
People of Coolock at the moment are very nervous, because you must remember there's a narrative out there that there's a good chance something serious is going to happen to one of your kids. That's out there. They have this worry.
In the violent protests.
In the violence. There's other narratives coming out that to say that, you know, I don't want to...
But are you sort of hearing that they're broadly fearful of having male asylum seekers moving into an area?
Very much so. Okay. There's the gap. Exactly.
No one is talking about what exactly is happening.
What could happen?
We have countless areas all over Ireland now where asylum seekers have moved in. Crime has not gone up in those areas. Some crimes have gone up. Arson attacks, but not by asylum seekers.
Absolutely.
By the very tiny, tiny minority of anti-immigration people who have turned violent.
I will say that there's probably 2 million males living in Ireland and we're unvetted, in the sense that we're all unvetted.
Yeah.
Let's get that one straight. We're unvetted. Yeah. Yeah. Now, I was vetted a few times in my previous jobs, and that's okay.
By the corpo. But it is. We're laughing. But that is that is the language that some people actually believe.
Yeah.
You know, unvetted, military-aged men.
Yeah, yeah. This just becomes the new narrative, and this is where dialogue...
And it sounds dangerous.
It needs to be dealt with. It really does.
But in actual fact, they're living in communities surrounded by military-age men who are unvetted. Yeah. It is just the imagined threat that they're concerned about. But as we've seen in the case of Coolock, the violence has come from a homegrown element, which is very small and very extreme. George Finglas, I hope you get your area back.
Can I just give a little shout out to... I'm involved with the Men's Shed.
Yes, please do. Yeah.
We're in operation... 10 and a half years now, homeless, only for the goodness of the likes of Spear 17, who allowed, this is a youth club, who allowed us to use their
club
premises.
That's Spear 17.
Spear 17. Okay. We'd be lost without them.
And you are the Priorswood and District Men's Shed.
And then we'd have the likes of Travact, who allow us to hold our art group. Then we'd have the likes of the Priorswood House. They would allow our music group to practice in their unit. See, we're farming because we haven't got our own space. And then we have the likes of the lads from the music group. They play for the local St. Joseph's old folks 3 days a week. So we very much give back to our community.
And you do card games, pool, that sort of stuff. Debating, I see, is one of the activities.
Absolutely, yeah.
There's a lot. And for sure, you do a great job in your community. And you've told us, you've really sold us the idea of Coolock of being such a lovely place, full of sound people.
Yeah.
And the headlines are bad, but it's not about the people there.
Not
sure.
at all.
No,
they're the best. The very best.
George Finglas. And what a name, Finglas.
Yeah.
From Coolock.
I'm going to change it by Deed Paul to Coolock.
George Coolock. It would suit you. It would suit you better. Listen, that's a nice note to end on. Thanks a million for coming into us. And I hope that things improve and that you're not living under that cloud of fear for much longer. 51551. Thanks, George.
Thank you very much.
Email oliver@rte.ie.
There you go. We always give you things to dwell upon of a weekend. It is the end of the podcast as you know it. If you have interesting stories and things you think we definitely should know, pop us an email anytime, please, oliver@rte.ie, and have a lovely weekend. Slán, thanks.